We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Darius Miller.
This is Drew Hardy.
This is Lance Thomas, Tyree Gavin.
Jason Smith.
Anthony Davis of the World's Pelicans.
You're listening to.
And you are listening to In the Know.
In the Know.
The Bourbon Street Shots.
Bourbon Street Shots podcast.
All Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. We're gearing up for the season, so that means we need to bring on Jerry V to talk about what he's seen in the preseason and everything else that's about to start Wednesday night. Jerry, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure as always, guys.
So, have you been watching preseason games?
Which player has
impressed you the most so far for the Pelicans?
Anthony Davis has been head and shoulders above everyone else. I want to see now if that's going to transfer to the regular season, but he's been very impressive, running the ball well. Rivers has done some nice things. He's shown me and he's made me very curious as to what kind of regular season he's had. More importantly, though, collectively as a team, guys, is that the Hornets are playing at a faster pace. And I want to see if that's going to transfer to the regular season, because Monty Williams is deliberately looking to push it. They've done that. I looked at some numbers a little while ago and how much weight it has in the from preseason to regular season. But I think it's impressive because we're dealing with the Pelicans. They were top 11 in the NBA, number of possessions per game in preseason. Does that transfer over? I don't know, but at least it shows they're giving the effort in accelerating the game, which they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times people think of the faster teams as the teams that get a lot of fast break points, when really pace is, you know, San Antonio doesn't get a ton of fast break points, but they really they get the ball up quick. They get into their offensive sets with, 20, 22 seconds on the shot clock at times. And it gives them more options, throughout the play, or allows them to take earlier shots. I mean, what do you expect from this offense as far as having multiple ball handlers on the court? Do you think that, they look to push at any time they get the chance? And I guess just in general, what have you seen from the offense that is vastly different from last year?
I see a deliberate attempt at getting what San Antonio does and what you call early spacing, guys, when you're going in transition. You brought up a good point. It doesn't necessarily have to mean the initial run right at the rim off the break, but early spacing with your wing runners getting out wide, you're creating early spacing in your early offense that goes over to the second point you made, creating options out of the half court. I'm seeing a little more of that. I'm seeing more attacking the lane off the dribble because you have the better personnel. I like that. And they're doing it earlier in the shot clock, so they're having that deliberate attempt. I'm curious as to how that'll transfer over 82 games, but Monty Williams has vowed, and he says, and he's wanted to for the past couple of seasons, to increase the tempo. He just didn't have the speed at the point guard play consistently enough to do that. Now he does, and now he's added the ability to also get in the lane and rim from wing positions with more consistency. So I'm looking at that. The ball handling has improved in the open floor. Foul line to foul line or circle to circle has improved in the open floor. Now we'll see if all that ties into your wings also consistently getting out wide and deep. So I see that deliberate attempt. We'll follow and get a nice body of games initially in the season, then we can measure it out.
So last season we spent a lot of time talking about two players, Vasquez and Lopez, who are now gone. We've replaced them with Holiday, who I think we're going to spend a little more time on later. But Lopez was not replaced one for one. It's kind of being replaced by committee. Who have you seen who you think makes the most sense starting off with that starting crew at the center position?
You know, and I knew that question was going to be asked, and my answer is a total blank because I haven't seen anything yet that's consistent enough to really make me feel comfortable, because I made a note to myself tonight with a question mark in my notebook, middle. Instead of labeling him as the center position, I put middle of the defense, and I got a question, two question marks around it. So that remains to be seen, because you don't have a guy yet that's in the middle that's diversified offensively. You also don't have a pure shot blocker type, and a pure shot blocker to me is the guy that can go get the block across the lane and the diagonal cut to go get it. That's not there yet, but we've seen glimpses of that. So I think after we look in the first 10 games of the season, we might have a clearer answer on that position. But right now, it's a mystery to me. Right now, that is a void, because nobody has left me with the comfortable feeling of that's my guy to patrol the middle of the defense, unless you're going to put Smith in there at times. But other than that, still a question mark.
Yeah, every year Monty always seems to have one position where he just rotates players through. Like people call it going in Monty's doghouse, but I tend to think of it more as a player gets his shot, doesn't really give him any confidence, so he gives another player a shot and then gives another player a shot, and then usually cycles back around to the first guy because he never finds what he wants.
Yeah,
are we in danger of seeing that?
Yeah, you're right.
So I think we're in danger of seeing that this year. Last game, though, Jason Smith did start in the middle. Do you think there's – I know Monty loves his energy off the bench, but do you think there's a possibility we see Jason Smith as a –
I think the chance you'll see that, but I think Monty also has a better understanding of the value of making sure you got good personnel coming off that bench, because he's seen the value of what it's done for some of the better teams. If you can have that firepower coming in and you put pressure on the other team's second team, that's a tremendous advantage when you're dealing in second and fourth quarters or when you're substituting to create matchup situations. So I think that's the ideal situation for them. But would I be surprised if he is forced to go with them at the center position early? No, I wouldn't be surprised at all. But what he would like to do is to make sure that he can keep, I call them hops, to keep hops coming off the bench, because he gives you hops. Offensive rebounding, runs the floor, the mid-range game, gives you the hustle play. I think that would be a nice pairing, a combination of guys with him and Evans coming off the bench.
And, I mean, you talk about firepower off the bench, and, I mean, it looks like the bench is going to consist of Tyreke Evans, Ryan Anderson, and I would say Anthony Morrow are locks at that 2-3-4 position. You've got your other big, whether it's Steemsma or Smith, depending on who starts the game. Who do you think, if I tell you those are the four off the bench, and now there's one more guard that's in that second unit, is Rivers or Roberts getting that 10 to 15 minutes?
Yeah, that's a great one there, because that's where the battle is. And I was thinking initially I was going to say Roberts, because I think he's more the point guard than Rivers is. Well, you would have Rivers at the swing, because Rivers still hasn't convinced me that he's that point guard. He's shown some glimpses, but I still don't get the feeling that he's that playmaking point guard. So if I want my point guard on the handle and to run it for me, surprisingly, I give the edge to Roberts until Rivers can convince me he can play that spot, because I have him locked in as a 2-3 type guy. If they go small ball, he can be the 3. I don't have him locked in as my point yet, although he looks like his game has improved to a degree, but I still have qualms about him being my one with that particular lineup.
So in the scrimmage, they just had a scrimmage recently, and I found it really interesting. It seemed like they were running starters versus their primary backups with a couple guys shifting in and out of those groups.
Right.
But Tyreek Evans, for a large portion of that scrimmage, ran the point for the bench squad.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect to see that to be a regular option?
I think we'll see him there at times, but I like him better at the swing because he's an ISO guy and he likes the ball in his hands, because if you're bringing him off the bench, you're bringing him off the bench to score the ball. You're not bringing him off the bench to share the ball. And as a swing player coming off the bench, he'll be the up-tempo guy. He'll be the guy to create something and make it happen. I think what you saw in the scrimmage was experimentation to see what it looked like. He had some glimpses of that out at Sacramento. He's an up-and-down straight-line point guard. He's not a playmaking point guard. That's why you got to look at it there. And I think the reason you saw some of that is coupled with the fact that they're looking to deliberately increase tempo and, you know, get that pace going. And he can be one of those guys. But I love him at the swing as my ISO guy, off pick and rolls, get it to the lane, get it to the rim, get me some numbers.
And, I mean, you can't really talk about this team and expectations without bringing up the guy who has the highest salary on this team. I guess I want to ask you this from a coaching perspective. If you could put yourself into Monty Williams' shoes, I mean, Eric Gordon has only played 51 games in the 2 years since he's been in New Orleans. Now in the preseason, doesn't play starting off. But when he does, he had three just absolutely fantastic games where he looks like far and away the best pure scorer on this team. But knowing that in the back of your mind that this guy is injury prone, if you're Monty Williams, how much, you know, when you go into this season, how much are you depending on Gordon versus, you know, how much are you almost half expecting him to get injured at this point and, you know, at some point, and having a contingency plan if he does?
I'll work my way backwards. One, I better have a contingency plan in the back of my head, and I believe he does. Two, he's got to be healthy. He has to contribute and play, because enough already, and this is the season I call the enough already season. He's got to be a major contributor on this basketball team. The trend is disturbing as far as health, and you cannot ignore health trends in professional sports. That worries me. I'm not going to bank on him. I could see him playing out of the 82 games, maybe 65 games. I'm anticipating that because I'm not sold on the fact on his durability yet, nor is he a guy that can play with any kind of pain. So contingency plan is in set. But as I said, this is my enough already year. Enough already. Show me something. Be a major contributor. Be the baller that you can be, because this is it. I mean, you got to do something this year and be a major contributor on this team. They didn't make all of those offseason acquisitions for nothing. They're hoping they can sneak into the eighth or the seventh seed in the playoffs. They need him to be a main guy, to score and be there and be reliable so they can go to him. And if he shows that he can, and they're not making that big push, he could be the guy that you can parlay to maybe get you another player later on in your roster. But he's got to contribute this year. Something has to happen on a positive note consistently.
So, and you brought it up, like, so he plays, say, 65 games. He misses 17 games a season. And maybe, you know, hopefully more than that if they hit the playoffs. But not that I'm hoping that he misses more. That came out wrong. But 65 games. Salaries aside, is that a disaster if he plays 65 games and he plays at least fairly well? Maybe not like what his peak was a couple of years ago, but pretty well. Is it a disaster, or does it not matter because Tyreek's around?
Not if he's getting you the night in and night out double figures and he's a consistent player. And the nights of the soreness, maybe you're going to rest him, and if he's playing well. It's a disaster if he's playing that number of games and he's inconsistent. If he's consistent, then it's not a disaster. Of course, you got to get play from the other people. because guys with that health trend, to look at it and say, oh, he's going to go the full 82 again. I don't buy that. It'd be nice. I'd love to see it happen, but I'm not sold on it, nor do I anticipate that he will.
Yeah, I'm just kind of hoping. I'm like, my best case scenario here is a poor man's Manu Ginobili, because Manu came like consistently every year. He missed a good 15 to 20 games.
That's right.
And he was there when it mattered, but he was always hurt. So I'm hoping maybe Eric Gordon gets to that point where, like, yeah, maybe he's hurt for a chunk of the season and it's not great, but at least he's doing what you need him to.
Yeah, and the difference between the two, though, Ginobili is hurt because he plays with total abandonment. He throws himself into the game, and that's why they love him. And then when he's available, he's clutch and he's fearless. It's not like the little nagging things that he gets. He gets the little injuries that he gets or the major ones that keep him out consistently. One is for health reasons, Pop limiting minutes, knowing he's going to need him down the stretch. Number two is how he plays. You know, every time he drives into the lane, he's fearless. He'll throw himself into a truck. I'd like to see Gordon begin to play, not with the crazy total abandonment, but to come out and be the player that he is supposed to be, to ignite things and play with a tenacity and get that personality going and unleash. You know, unleash and engage. That's what I want to see him do. No more tentativeness. He needs to be the guy that can play and start to turn it loose this year, because you know, the patience, it's getting thin.
Yeah, and I mean, another guy who came over in that trade for Chris Paul, Al-Farouq Aminu, is a guy the Pelicans did not pick up his option this summer. It was a risky game they played. They risk Al-Farouq finding a contract elsewhere and leaving. He comes back on a one-year deal. And, you know, looks like a different player this preseason. What have you noticed in the little bit of time that we've got to see him this preseason, and what do you expect this year?
A little more assertive offensively. It looks like he's deliberately hunting offensively. He's been told to do that. Still not as consistent as you would like at a small forward. I want to see, and I've seen him hunt a little more, and by that I mean trying to put it on the floor, trying to attack the rim, which a small forward is supposed to be able to do in this league. You got to be able to jump shoot the ball, and a small forward has to be able to get into the lane off the dribble. He's tried that, and he's worked it. There are times I see a hesitancy and still at times struggling to read how the game is flowing in front of him. But, again, it's preseason, and the emphasis on the turnovers and the emphasis to run the ball has disguised a couple of things, but that can benefit him, because he's a better straight-line player, open floor, get to the rim with a lot of space versus having to execute in the half court. He could be that guy that can benefit if they can be consistent in accelerating the pace, because he's an outstanding open floor runner. He can fly in the open floor. He could be that wing guy that creates that spacing for you that you want in the early offense. The only problem is you wish, if he's going to be the guy to help create the spacing, that he can shoot the ball with a little more distance, because then that would be tremendous. Be tremendous if he was capable to shoot the three. But he isn't a three-baller, but he's a terrific runner. He's a pitch-ahead guy. Toss it ahead to him and run to the hole with it. That's where he can greatly benefit.
Yeah, so we're leery of poor Al-Farouq, because we've seen flashes before where he's looked pretty impressive for a few games, and this is preseason, but I mean, he is 23. We're hoping that maybe he's going to make a leap, and I don't know. He's been taking jump shots and making them. Do you think that's mostly because of the preseason, that they're just, or are they just leaving him open and we can see maybe he'll be left open the rest of the season?
It's possible. Lot of gym time. It was one of the offseason projects. He knew he had to come back and legitimize his jumper,
okay.
But that will help him. I think by the fact that they're playing faster has helped him. They're trying to do things earlier in the offense. That has helped him. And he is one guy, you put a star next to his name, you put a notation, if pace increases, Aminu improves. If they go back and pull it back and they find out, wait a minute, we can't do this, then it goes back to the old frustrating, okay, what are you going to show me? But if they can get it going, he's a guy that you'll see, because he's a 47% field goal shooter, but it's misleading because, you know, the dunks and the layups and all go into that field goal percentage formula. But if he can be that guy and they can get that early spacing because of their ball handling and improved guard play, we might see a different style player with a style of play will disguise what he can't do, but enhance what he can do. And I think that's key for him. But it was an assignment for him, guys. I mean, it was mandated. You got to go home and get a jumper. You got to go home and work off the dribble and get a shot. You have to. And I think he's shown some of that because of the extra gym time.
Yeah, and circling back, we started off with Anthony Davis. He's saying that he's head and shoulders the best player on the team this preseason. I mean, just looking at this roster and Greg Steensma, Jason Smith. I mean, Jason Smith is really more of a power forward, but he'll be forced to play center. But regardless, there's going to have to be somewhere between 13 and 20 minutes a night where Anthony Davis is going to have to play the center position. I know you love him as a power forward, but really this team, you know, would be wasting great talent if they didn't get him and Ryan Anderson on the floor together for at least 10 to 15 minutes a night. How do you think he's going to respond to playing more center this season? And, I mean, do you give us the pros and cons of where it'll help his game and where it might hurt?
Well, with him, he can play the center position in a different way instead of the lock down on the box back to the basket guy. He can be the center that can float up the lane. You know, it can create a matchup problem because if he's your center and he's matched up with another five, Davis has shown in the preseason an improvement of putting the ball on the floor, which can make him a tough cover against other centers. So he can come up the lane, mid-range jumper. He can move without the ball across the lane with his maneuverability could make it tough for other fives. And there's going to be times, of course, he can play with the back-to-the-basket game, and then there we'll find out what kind of a passer he evolves into because he's going to get a lot of attention defensively. So when people think center, I think a lot of fans think back-to-the-basket lock-in type of power center. He could be that European-type center who can shoot the jumper, he can move without the ball, and he can run the floor to make other bigs have to chase him. So I look at him that way. So maybe the hybrid center might be the tag that we put on him because matchups and position definition are changing in the NBA by the length of players and the skill sets now. You know, it used to be point guard, a two and a three. Now they're wings. Same with that center position, unless you have a Dwight Howard, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, back to the basket type power guy.
So Anthony has shown that he's trying to attack more. He always seems to be the kind of guy who kind of he's having a lot of impact without being overt about it.
Right.
He's not like demanding the ball. He's not like they're not running set after set after set for him, or at least he's not the primary option of those sets. Do you think that when the regular season starts that he is going to become more featured? Or do you think this is really what he's going to get, his few sets per game, a couple every quarter, and mostly they expect him to do damage, cutting, moving off the ball, mm-hmm. and cleaning things up?
There will be deliberate calls for him because I think you have to get him certain touches in certain spots on the floor. Other times he'll get touches just out of the evolving, out of the offense. He'll create his own touches, going to the glass and running the floor because he's a terrific runner. But yes, there will be times they will play through him. I think the big test for him will be, has he improved his passing and reading the floor skills? And the reason that I say that, because if the option comes and you're going to run him at the bottom of the box, he'll see doubles, he'll see people digging out and converging on him. Is he going to be able to find cutters? Will he be able to score, to throw the scoring pass? I think that's the next part of his game I want to see evolve. But yes, he will get deliberate calls. Will there be an increase on the number of deliberate calls for him? Not to sacrifice the flow of the offense unless he's having one of those nights because he moves so well. So as he learns to move and he gets better at it within the flow using screens and cuts, he can create extra catches for himself out of a particular play. But he will get deliberate calls because you have to get a guy like that so many touches that are mandated just to get him going. I want to see how much he's improved guys from last year, because people were putting a lot of pressure on him and saying that he's going to be the reason you're going to get into the playoffs. He's only going to be as good as the guard play. If the guard play doesn't perform, Anthony Davis is not going to have the impact year many people want him to have. Oh, he might have 18 and 10 boards, but will they be the 18-10 that's winning ball games, or the 18-10 because that's all you're getting and you're not getting anything from enough people, if you follow my point on that? So I think guard play is going to be directly related to what kind of a season he's going to have, feeding the post, finding him, playmaking, out of the pick and roll, all of those factors.
So you're talking guard play. I mentioned it before. He's the one guy, I think, the biggest acquisition the Pelicans made this summer that could have a real massive impact on this team. Jrue Holiday.
Yeah.
What have you seen?
Huh?
What's that?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm just trying to figure out. He's had turnover issues.
Yeah.
But he has increased the speed of the game. He's getting his assists. He's clearly going to be a better defensive player than Vasquez was last year. But do you see him as the possible second best player on a really good team?
I think he's a guy that's going to have to be in your top three. The toughest thing for Holiday to have, he had to do more in Philly than he's going to have to do here because he didn't have the supporting cast that he'll have here. He's going to have that old school Oscar Robinson comment that I never forget when I sat with Oscar Robinson in a talk studio and we chatted for an hour. And he said the toughest thing that he ever had to learn to play, and I think it works here, and that all young players have to play, have to master, even especially guards, is when to shoot and when to pass. And I think that's going to fit Holiday right there to the T. Because in Philly, he had the quickness, the handle to the lane, the pull-up, the pick-and-roll. Even though he was sloppy out of the pick-and-roll, some of that is attributed to the personnel in the pick-and-roll with him. But now he's in a position where if he's on the floor with the Davis, he's on with an Anderson or maybe an Evans or an Eric Gordon, now he's going to have to decide, okay, I got to sacrifice some of my field goal attempts to become the playmaker, to set my guys up, get the ball up the floor, handle, make this thing go. When do I pass it? When do I shoot it? When do I make the play on my own? I think that's going to be the toughest challenge for him. Will he be able to handle it? I think he will. But I think a vital thing to think about, guys, when you look at the additions to this club, is going to be that shot distribution, when and where and et cetera, when to share it, when not to share it. So his mentality is going to change a little bit because he's going to have to be a leader handling the ball for yourself instead of him at Philly where, hey, I got to get us some points here because no one is scoring. He's going to have more help here. So we might see him evolve into a better player because he's going to be able to showcase some things that he gets to do with a greater frequency than he had to do in Philadelphia, which is playmake and pass the ball. That's a storyline I want to watch carefully. I think it could be entertaining.
So if I told you that over the course of the season he averaged 11 shots a game,
mm-hmm.
think that's about right for him?
It depends how many points you're averaging per game. How are those shots coming? Are they coming off jumpers? Is he getting to the rim in the open floor? Is he getting them because of steals? Are they layups open floor, layups out of the half court? Are they jumpers? Is he getting jumpers because they're swinging the ball back to him after he's thrown the initial pass and they throw it back to him on the weak side? He's open and he has to make that shot. You know, when you're running sideline pick and rolls on the other side of the floor and the ball comes out of the point guard's hands, generally that point guard is wide open on the swing back. So does he get it that way? Or is he getting 11 shots a game because he's taking them because he wants to take them? So it all depends on how he gets the 11. But the 11 is just a number on a standalone basis. It sounds about right. Now, if he's getting them with 11 shots a game, he's getting his assist and he's defending well, we can have ourselves a very, very nice player here. I want to see how the sharing of the ball is going to evolve with this club this year, if they can maintain getting it up and down the floor the way they did in the preseason. because they desperately need to do that. They need to increase the shot attempts, three attempts, and free throw attempts. And if they can do that by keeping that tempo up, I think that they will. I think they'll increase those numbers.
So I guess I want to give you a little bit more of a broad question. Just looking at this roster, I mean, obviously, sports in general are a game of matchups.
Right.
And, you know, Team A could beat Team B, and then Team B could beat Team C, but that doesn't always mean that Team A is going to beat Team C. Just looking at this roster and what they do well, what they do poorly, what types of teams do you think that the Pelicans will have success against? And then, you know, what types of teams, or you could even maybe give specific teams, do you think that they might struggle against?
Well, they can beat teams like the Philadelphia's, Phoenix, and Boston, you know, the Orlando's, Sacramento's, the Hawks, the Bobcats, Toronto, et cetera. They can match up with them. Teams that they'll struggle against will, of course, be the Miami's and the Spurs and I think the Pacers and Bulls because of their ability and the toughness on how they play and the depth of their personnel. Now, those are individual teams. The style of team that I think that they would struggle in based on last year, because we haven't seen them play this year, are teams that have terrific ball movement a la San Antonio, a la Miami. Even though some people look at Miami and they say, no, ain't LeBron James and all, Miami moved the ball better when it really mattered than a lot of clubs in the league. Teams with ball movement, misdirection, weak side actions that really flow into early offense off the initial attack is where they'll struggle, because the Pelican defense off the ball last year was horrendous. It was horrible. Their overall team defense was below fair. It wasn't consistent enough. And that's another area we got a great Anthony Davis on as the game evolves. Those style teams hurt them. Quick ball swings, you know, drive, kick, swing, weak side pin downs, ball reversals, etc. Because the heads would turn, and they made so many mistakes last year on rotations and closeouts and who is where, who's got that cutter, who takes the screener, who's taking this guy, etc. There was confusion. Those are the teams that can hurt them. But if they've improved in that area, then the comment I just made can get erased. And that's where all of us here will keep our fingers crossed and hope that collectively as a team defense, they've improved in those areas. If they haven't improved in those areas, this could be a tough year.
Yeah. Defensively, I have no idea how this team is going to end up playing.
Yeah, and you know another thing too, guys, if the tempo increases, while that's going to be a happy time to say, wow, they've accelerated the pace, this is dynamite. Defensively now, it's a different mindset, because if you're going to push, if let's say you're going to run off a defensive rebound and you're in the open floor, now your transition defense has to be emphasized tremendously to cover back. And anytime you're playing in the open floor, there's going to be mismatches, and that's going to force excellent communication. So you're going to be challenged again, but you're going to have to defend a larger area of the court and make quicker decisions, not like you're in the half court. So while you improve in one area offensively, it increases the challenges that you're going to have defensively. But I would rather you and I in our next conversation, let's say we're 10 games into the season, say, wow, we're really happy with this accelerated pace. Yeah, but they gave up 17 points off the break. Yeah, but the Pelicans had 19, and they're getting more shots, so we're seeing that area of growth. So you're going to have to give in one area, may sacrifice in the other in the early stages. And I hope I made that point clear enough.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to put you on the spot before we let you go, Jerry.
Oh, I love spots.
So
Monty Williams on a hot seat? You going to ask me that question?
No, not yet. I think we'll wait and see how this happens. How this works out a little bit before we do it. But so the first month, the schedule's pillow soft for the Pelicans. But their first real game as the New Orleans Pelicans is against a very tough opponent in Indiana. It's going to come in on the 30th. Give us your prediction for the game. Is the first game as the Pelicans, are they going to be winners or losers?
Oh, I mean, I hope they're a winner, but Indiana's good enough. I mean, Indiana's one of those teams. Remember, they beat the Miami Heat 5 times in the past 2 playoff years. Nobody has done that, or it's the past 3 years. Indiana's going to be a tough cover. I don't know if the Pelican defense is ready for that game one, but I'm going to come out and go on a limb and say that game one opening night, new Pelicans and all, they win a squeaker against the Pacers.
Hey, I like it.
Yeah.
All right, thanks very much for coming on, Jerry.
Gentlemen,
and
it's always a
pleasure. We'll be bringing you on more often to talk all about this team, of course.
Always a pleasure. Looking very much to the season and working with you guys at Bourbon Street Shots.
Yeah. And thanks for coming on.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right, so Jerry's predicting a squeaker win against the Pacers. You on board with that?
Yeah, I mean, Pelicans got a little bit of good news, though it's bad news for a Louisiana native. Danny Granger's not going to play in that game. He's out at least 3 weeks now. You know,
Sorkast.
Yeah, feel bad for the guy. Hopefully he does something productive this season. But he's not going to play. Indiana's also going to be on the second night of a back-to-back. We know that just percentage-wise over the last couple of years in the NBA, teams with the second night of a back-to-back on the road win about 36% of the time. So, yeah, a couple things lining up in the Pelicans' favor. Going to be a good, you know, crowd, home game, everybody excited. They're going to unveil the mascot. You know, I think there'll be a lot of energy in there. I really expect a win, especially after how I saw how well, you know, the core guys played against Miami in the, you know, the exhibition game this past week and just played in the exhibition season overall.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll say this about the Pacers. I think the most important item there is which Hibbert shows up. Because Hibbert, for those people who didn't pay attention outside of the playoffs, I mean, to them, Hibbert's an incredible center who's very productive.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the playoffs, he was great. But the entire regular season, this is a guy who averaged, I think it was like 12-8. We're not talking amazing numbers or a dominating force. In fact, the first month and a half of last season, they were talking about how much of a bust he was on that contract because he was just so bad for a while. So I don't know which Hibbert's going to show up. The Pelicans are uniquely constructed as a donut team so that he could have a gigantic game against them. And if that Hibbert shows up, one who is dominating and playing hard and scoring in the middle, the Pelicans are going to have a tough time. But if it's the normal regular season Hibbert that shows up, I'm not that concerned about this team. I'm a little interested to see. I have a feeling that the Pelicans are going to be an offensive team, that they hang their hat on their offense and not their defense, and come running up against a defensive chainsaw. That'll be fun to watch to see what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that Hibbert is important. I also think, I mean, there was a game last year where we were right there with Indiana, and David West just kind of took over and, you know, scored something like 8 out of 10 points or 10 out of 12. I can't remember. But that's going to be an interesting matchup. I mean, just physically, Anthony Davis wins that matchup. He's obviously got the length, the speed, the young legs with David West coming on a back-to-back, you know, the ability to rim run. But David West, we saw it for, you know, several years here, has a lot of moxie, just a really clever guy who could get points, who Indiana could go to late in games. I mean, I'm looking at this Pelicans roster and I see a ton of talent. If you tell me that the game is tied with, you know, a minute and a half left to go in the game, I have no clue who, you know, who Monty's going to draw up as the number one option on those last couple of possessions. I think Indiana has a guy in West. If he's hot, they obviously have a guy in Paul George that they could go to. I see five guys on this Pelicans team who could score. I don't know if Monty even knows right now who the number one option would be.
That's true. Yeah. I will say that watching David West for all those years, the kind of guys that it scared me, that I thought West always had a bad matchup against, were tall, extremely long guys. I remember, like, the Lakers were a nightmare for us when Lamar Odom was available. When he could come out and take West in the key moments, Lamar was just long and could drape over him and contest his shots and was quick enough to, like, counter his moves and made Dave West miserable. But if he wasn't available and it was, like, Paul Gasol that West was torching, it was, like, 35-point games. So I think Anthony Davis is uniquely built to make David West's life miserable. But we'll see. I don't even know who's going to get the call. Like, in this situation, is Monty going to go with Jason Smith, who he's called his best big man defender, on someone like David West? Or is he going to let Anthony Davis take on that challenge? This is all stuff that we have no idea what the answer is going to be. I'm just fascinated to find out.
Yeah, I mean, Monty shifting things up right to the last moment. Just got official word today that Jason Smith's going to be the starter next to Anthony Davis. I absolutely love the decision. I think it helps the first unit, obviously, with spacing. I think it helps the second unit because, you know, if there is such a thing, I almost thought there were too many scorers on the second unit. Like, how are you going to get shots for Roberts, Evans, Morrow, Anderson, and Smith? I mean, there was nobody on that second unit who, you know, didn't need the ball to really be successful at times. Now Steemsma could basically just be a guy who crashes the offensive boards, who gives you defense, and, you know, it puts a little bit more pressure on Evans and Anderson to really fill it up with that second unit. I just think it's a great decision by Monty, and hopefully it's something that, you know, they could get away with defensively, because, you know, when you look at these first couple of games, though, overall, you know, they are, it's kind of a cupcake. It's the easiest part of the schedule. You got both Gasols in the first 10 games. You've got Roy Hibbert. You have Al Jefferson, who's a load. You have Vucevic, who is a guy who really crashes the boards and is showing more and more skill at the center position. So, you know, we're going to know right away if Jason Smith could give you those minutes at the five to start off games. I think we've seen more and more as the preseason gone on that Monty is comfortable playing Anderson and Davis together. And, you know, really, if they could even just be competent on the defensive end when those two guys are in, the offensive potential is enormous. We saw small stretches. I mean, really, it was just a small stretch in the first quarter of the Orlando exhibition game where the five guys that we think are going to finish games were on the court. And it was just absolutely gorgeous basketball already. And this was literally the first time those five have been on the court together in a game that actually, you know, was being officiated and, you know, as close as you could get to a real game. So I think it's really going to be exciting, but it's weird. As excited as we are about this season and as much as we think we know about these individual players, there's just so many general unknowns for this team.
So I'm going to make a prediction for the season. Tyreke Evans will win the Sixth Man of the Year this year.
Really?
And I was really leery to say that because Ryan Anderson's on this team. And how can you even honestly say that Tyreke Evans is the real sixth man of this team when Ryan Anderson's coming off the bench as well and may even play more minutes? But I really do believe that Tyreke Evans is going to be a more versatile version of Jamal Crawford this season. Crawford is a pure ISO scorer off the bench, and I fully 100% expect that Tyreke Evans is going to be just have the ball in his hands. He's going to make all the decisions off the bench. Brian Roberts may be next to him, but he'll be playing off the ball, and Tyreke Evans will be doing all the attacking, and he might be feeding Ryan Anderson when he gets into the middle. But I really do think that he is going to be scoring somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 16 points a game and also be grabbing about 4 to 5 assists per game, and that's going to put him in the top and sixth man award.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to believe that. I just have some reservations. I've said this in the past. I know I wrote about this in the past, but looking back at previous sixth man of the year winners, I mean, on average, they usually have 16, sometimes 17 field goal attempts per game. I mean, usually they're coming off the bench, but they almost always finish games. And, you know, when they come off the bench, they really fill it up, because usually they are one of the only, if not the only, legitimate scoring threats off the bench. And I just don't see it. I mean, Tyreek got about 32 minutes per game last year, and he only took a little over 12 shots a game. I think his minutes go down. So I think he could be the best player off the bench in the NBA this year, but I don't think that necessarily means he wins Sixth Man of the Year, because I don't think he's going to be able to get the raw stats that he'll need to get that award. I think if, you know, for the guys who are really into efficiency, or again, like I said, if we're just talking about the best bench player in the NBA, I agree he could be that, but it's just bound to happen that there's going to be a sixth man who jacks up 16, 17, 18, 19 shots per game, and just based off of that. And also, if he's on a higher profile team or a team that's winning more, I just think it's really going to be hard for Tyreek to win that award, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be hard for him to be the best player off the bench in the NBA this year.
Okay, you're wrong, but okay.
I would love to take the field in any bet if you really want to take Tyreek. But again, like I said, I don't care about awards. If he's the best player off the bench in the NBA, but some other guy wins the award, you know, I would be very happy with that season. Another award that I think is funny, you laughed at me last year every time I brought this up. I said, you know, Anthony Davis was so hidden by Monty and so off the national radar that he legitimately could be the most improved player in his second year. ESPN's panel of experts, writers, whatever you want to call them, they made their predictions for all the awards this year.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
And the two guys who got the most votes and most improved player, Eric Bledsoe and Anthony Davis. Do you still think it's a joke, or do you think that Anthony Davis has a legitimate shot at winning most improved player this year?
Okay, so he has a chance of winning it. If he wins it, it's ridiculous. I mean, there is no way you can take a guy who played as well as he did last year and what minutes he got and say that suddenly he's improved incredibly, when probably he's going to get more minutes, but he's not going to, like, suddenly, unless he like turns into frickin' Tim Duncan in his rookie season, you can't really say that Anthony Davis is going to be the most improved. He'll be improved, and he'll get more minutes, and his stats will look very nice. But yeah, I'm not a fan of the whole, it's a guy in his second season and he got better stats. I don't like that. So I'll continue to laugh at you when you say it. But there's a chance. Writers vote for all kinds of stupid things. Sometimes.
Right.
I'm a writer. I vote for stupid stuff.
The awards are not about reality. It's about predicting how writers who have very little time to somehow follow all 30 teams are going to vote. I mean,
well,
we had Amin on, and Amin admitted that nobody could watch all 30 teams. So really, it's just going to be the buzz. It's going to be, you know, about perception. And the perception, I mean, I read an article, a Yahoo article from this past week, talking about the Pelicans. And one of the lines in there was, Anthony Davis still has a chance to come out as the best player of the 2012 draft. It's still possible. Like, I mean, somebody actually wrote that. So,
right.
You know, I knew the national perception on him was just down and ignorant. You know, Bill Simmons is even taken back. He had a tweet in which he said that he did the Pelicans preview way before Anthony Davis blew up in the preseason. And if he could do it again, he would have put the Pelicans in the top 15. I mean, all of these guys thought that Anthony Davis was a disappointment last year and not very good. When he blows up this year, I mean, I could honestly see him getting votes for most improved player, even though the reality of it is that, you know, the improvement is there, but, you know, it's not going to be as as monumental as it looks like when people just look at his raw stats.
Yeah. So actually, our buddy Amin did something very clever in those predictions. And I thought it was funny because he was just on our podcast talking about how he thought Monty could legitimately be on a hot seat this year, that because he didn't think he was going to be able to change his style. He also put Monty, he voted Monty as coach of the year for the season.
Yeah,
you saw that?
Not only so, did I saw it, see it, but I contacted Amin about it because I figured it would be so, it was so odd and kind of a disappointing answer. Apparently there was a mix up at ESPN and that is,
oh, come on.
That is not who he voted for. Somebody else must have, and then they put the other person's in a mean spot and vice versa. But Amin, is on the record saying that he did not actually cast that vote for Monty, that it was just a mix up by the editors.
Okay, well then he's not as clever as I thought he was.
He thought he was.
Take that, I mean. Because here's the thing. The guys who win the Coach of the Year every year are the guys who are coaching teams that all of the media thought were going to be mediocre or bad. And they take that team to mediocre or good based on, so they outperform the media's expectations.
Right.
And so then they win the coach of the year. It wasn't that they were necessarily great coaches. Maybe their team was just, the media wasn't really paying attention to what was there. So I thought it was kind of clever to vote for Monty, because right now the expectations are, for most people who aren't fans like us or paying attention a lot like us, are outside of the playoffs. 10th seed, 9th seed, maybe. But they're probably not making the playoffs. But after what we saw this preseason, after we've seen how the team's doing, it seems a lot wiser to now say, well, hey, our expectations were meh, and they could be not bad. So vote for the guy who will get credit for that, who is Monty Williams.
Yeah, let me ask you this. Who do you think has a better chance, Monty Williams winning Coach of the Year or Dell Demps winning Executive of the Year?
Huh. I would say Monty Williams.
Oh, okay.
And the reason why I say that is because I still think that the general sentiment about what Dell Demps is goes against, I said this before, it goes against the sexy two theories of how you build a team. And there are still like writers who have bought into that story, that narrative, that this is the way you build a team. And the good guys do that. And until somebody does it a different way and proves differently, that's how you do it. And therefore, they're not going to want to give Dell Demps any credit because he flouted that. I mean, we're still getting like pieces that talk about how Dell Demps is doing an analytics approach to team building. Which, I mean, where does that even come from? None of these guys look like amazing analyticals. Tyreek Evans looks fairly solid last year, but Drew doesn't look amazing. But they're 23, and you can actually project how players develop from that age, and they look fine or good. So it's basically somebody looked at the last year's stats, looked at PER, looked at a couple true shooting percentages, and said, they suck. Dell Demps doesn't like analytics.
Yeah, I go the other way. I think, so I could see best case scenario, Pelicans win around 50 games. I could still see other coaches, I could see, the Clippers just having a crazy year. Like I said, just going all out this season and Doc getting coach of the year. I just think there's so many more candidates where even those analytic guys who like gave Philadelphia an A and us a C minus for that trade. Well, they're not going to vote for Philadelphia's GM as GM of the year when they go 10-72. Right. There's a lot more teams off the board, either because A, they didn't do anything. So you look at a team like Oklahoma City, they literally did absolutely nothing this off season except for let a guy go. Those teams aren't going to win it. The Spurs aren't going to win it for adding Ginobili and dropping Neal. I mean, there's so many teams that did little to nothing. Then there's so many other teams who are purposely tanking. I think, you know, the GM of the year is going to go to a GM who did something bold this pass off season. To me, there's only a couple of teams that fit that criteria. And then if the Pelicans, you know, go on and win, you know, I think that Demps is, I actually think he's one of the favorites for that award, only because, again, I think the only guys who are really have a chance to win it are ones who did something bold this off season. And, that, you know,
that's a very good argument. You might have swayed me with that one, because you're right. There aren't a lot of executives that a writer who doesn't know a lot about the teams could point to and say that guy did this and that resulted in wins. You could say so basically your candidates right now are Bob Myers and Golden State. I guess you could probably go, who is the official GM in Indiana? Is it Larry Legend or is it Pritchard?
I really don't know where
they have a weird front office, yeah, where they've like shared titles.
Yeah, they're in transition phase. I really don't know where they're at this point.
So whoever's in charge, you know, that might make it hard in Indiana. Whoever's in charge of Indiana, because they redid their bench, and if they do pretty well this season, I think that guy has a chance.
But most people think they're the team that's right there in conjunction with. Wouldn't they have to basically finish like first in the East?
Yeah, but they could still win that. I mean, that's possible.
Yeah.
Detroit, because they did take some risk with the two signings they went after.
Right.
My dark horse, though, the one who I think will win it this year, and it's just based on how he's performed in the past, I think the guy whose name I will slaughter probably mercilessly, Masai Ujiri in Toronto. I think he is going to trade Rudy Gay early on this season, bring back some players that people are like, meh, they suck compared to Rudy Gay. And he'll promptly hit the playoffs, a low seed in the Eastern Conference playoffs, 43 wins. And everybody like, wow, he stepped in, dumped Bargnani, dumped Rudy Gay, made this awesome team, and it's all him. He's awesome. We love Masai Ujiri, and he'll win.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know who it'll be. It'll be somebody. But I mean, yeah, what if Denver comes out of nowhere? I mean, their bold move was letting somebody go. But what if they come out of there and you know, all these little pieces, you know, winding, get them to exceed expectations. But I think, you know, Dems has a good shot. Again, I don't really care as much about the awards. It's nice for the franchise to get recognition. You know, I guess hopefully if and when that happens, you have less people calling us the Hornets and, you know, Pelicans catch on faster. But I don't know. I think I guess I'm just getting so excited for this season. I put my projections out there. We did basically a season preview piece. People who are listening to this podcast will probably have read it by then, so hopefully I'm not spoiling anything. You know, I had an exact record that I put out there. I'll go on the record right now. I'm saying that I think that we go 3-0 this week. Before the next podcast you hear, I think the Pelicans will be 3-0. I expect us to win 46 games this season. Go on the record now. What are you predicting?
I actually think that they're going to lose their first game of the season. I think that this team's offense has to gel a little bit. I think they're going to be hanging their hat. I think this is going to be a fun team to watch. It's going to be fast. They're going to be jacking up jumpers from all over. They'll be driving and attacking and driving and attacking. I have a real feeling that this Pelicans team is going to become one of the league pass darlings this season. And I think their defense is going to be bad. It's going to be 22nd, 23rd in the league. And they're going to be entirely hanging everything on their offense. And that's going to take a few, like, you know, at least a few weeks to gel before they're able to attack on all cylinders and beat good defenses. So I think that when they hit the Pacers wall, because the Pacers are a brutal defensive team, they're going to have a hard time in that first game. And then I think they're going to start ripping wins off pretty quickly after that. But I also predict that I was going for 45 wins, so I'm one short of you. We're pretty similar. I think we kind of covered that in our Western Conference preview about where we thought they would end up. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, it's going to be an exciting season. The preseason has been nothing to damper my expectations. I thought that, you know, even the way that they finished, I thought the Miami game, I thought the Pelicans straight up dominated their starters when the Pelicans starters were in. You know, obviously lost a lot of traction with that second unit. Going to be interesting to see how that unit gels. But, I mean, exciting preseason, 7-1. You know, usually a good omen when you're that good in the preseason. Good omen for your chances making the playoffs that year. So a lot to be excited about. I can't wait to come on this podcast. You know, you and I have been doing this podcast. This will be our fourth season now, our fourth season that we cover. The first year was fun. I mean, still had Chris Paul. We're a slightly above average team. Won, what was it, 46 games that year, I believe. But the last 2 years, I mean, just breaking down some of the misery of these games. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we always got to look to the future, but it's just going to be so exciting for us to break down, you know, a good team every week on this podcast, and I hope it's exciting for the listeners as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned briefly the two preseason games. I do need to say this. So last year I felt like I had the curse of Schwann going on. Every time I caught live, I usually watch it on tape delay, and every time I caught live basketball, the Hornets at the time were demolished. They just always lost badly. And then I started like doing little things like paying attention during games, and the other team always seemed to go on runs and beat the Hornets during those phases. But then I would tell myself, you're being stupid. This is a bad team. You're more likely to see the other team beating them than not beating them because they're always being beaten. So I kind of kicked myself for being a superstitious moron. Well, other than the one earlier game, I watched exactly 18 minutes of the Orlando and Miami games. During those 18 minutes, the Pelicans were outscored by 36 points. There was one run against Orlando where they came roaring back and took the lead. That was the only time against Orlando where they sucked, where the Pelicans played badly. And Miami, I watched the fourth quarter. That's it. That's all I saw of those two games, and it was the Pelicans being destroyed. So I don't know if I'm terrified that I'm going to start watching a game live, and this team is going to start losing. I know it's me. I'm a curse.
Yeah, I really hope that your address, whatever, isn't public, because if it's true, if the Pelicans start winning, like, people are going to straight up come to your house and just tie you up to a chair and make sure you don't watch the game. I wouldn't have admitted that with all of our listeners, but I don't think we have to worry about any of that happening this season. I mean, as I've tried to tell people in previous podcasts, you want to know what's going to happen. Play NBA 2K. I mean, NBA 2K from day one had Jason Smith as the starting center for the Pelicans. They just know what's going on. And I will say right now that I've started playing the season. So far, I'm 4-0. Drew Holiday's averaging close to 20-10. Davis is shooting about 62% from the field. And Evans is just tearing up second units, getting to the basket and getting to the free throw line. So, I mean, we could sit down here and break down all the numbers you want, talk to Jerry V, who has, you know, decades of seasons, you know, just studying basketball. None of that really matters. It's all what NBA 2K says. And, the future and the present actually is very bright according to that game. So I'm not worried at all.
So I just bring this up. I haven't actually gotten the new NBA 2K because I was in the middle of a My Player season from NBA 2K13. So I created a small forward, and ended up playing, of course, for the Hornets. And I made it to the NBA Finals. And this, I didn't really pay attention to standings. I didn't have any clue who was advancing in the Eastern Conference because I'm playing my player and just paying attention to what I'm doing. Do you know who I ended up facing in the finals and I could not figure out what had happened?
Rudy Gay and the Raptors?
The Philadelphia 76ers from last year.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, well, they had to have made, like, the game had to have made a trade in here. And the only thing that had happened that was different was Andrew Bynum had played 15 games for them that season, except instead of zero. But somehow that team still went on and not only made it to the NBA Finals in the Eastern Conference, but had the second seed in the entire league. So, I'm sorry, your NBA stuff's crazy.
Don't
trust 2K.
Yeah, and they're back at it again. I mean, Andrew Bynum's actually rated far higher than Anthony Davis on 2K14.
It's crazy.
Leaps and bounds above Ryan Anderson, so... you know,
Cleveland's going to go all the way, man.
Yeah, I'm telling you, they're probably pretty dominant on that game. But in all seriousness, you know, it's exciting to go into the season. I mean, this team is 100% healthy. They have everybody ready to go for game one. We haven't seen much of everybody playing together in the preseason. But when, you know, we saw a couple of those guys together, it was a team that really has a ton of options on the offensive end, and I agree with you. It's really going to come down to, you know, whether that defense could settle down and just be middle of the pack. It doesn't have to be great or even good this year. If they could be middle of the pack, you know, I think this team is a lock for the playoffs because of all the offensive weapons they have. So the first game against Indiana, you know, I think it's really going to be a test for the interior of that defense. And then also we're going to know right away, you know, whether the guards could get into the lane against good defensive teams, make things happen. I think they'll be able to. It's a nice test to start off the season, but I think some X factors, again, them being on the second day of a back-to-back and them being out without Danny Granger in our favor. And, you know, theoretically, you'd like to say you would love to beat a team like that at full strength, and but it's a long season. You have to take any advantages that you could get, even if that means the other team missing a player or not being at 100% because they're tired from the night before. So I'll take whatever you could get. And really, looking down the schedule, we both agreed that Memphis was a good matchup for this team. I mean, I don't think it's completely unreasonable that we see a start similar to the 2010-11 season where, you know, the Pelicans have one of the best, if not the best records in the NBA, 9, 10, 11 games into the season, just because, you know, of how soft that schedule is starting off.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So I'm looking forward to the season. Thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. And we'll be back after a few games have been played. By the way, you said the team was 100% healthy. You just broke Darius Miller's heart.
Oh, God, I forgot. That's our 14th man. Ugh. Terrible now.